This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Bill Dorman. It's called the Climate Summit. The idea came from Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti following President Trump's decision to pull out of the Paris Climate Accord. Close to 60 mayors representing large and small cities took part in a gathering yesterday leading up to the broader mayor's conference, which opens today. Mayor Garcetti announced details of an electric vehicle collective aimed at cutting carbon emissions.
This isn't about statistics or policies. This is about stories and people. This is about the amount of time we spend stuck in traffic and not being with our kids. This is about our life expectancy. This is about whether or not we're going to lose beaches and neighborhoods to rising sea tides. This is about firefighters who have died on the line facing record fires because of the droughts in places like the Western United States. This is about rebuilding entire American cities like New Orleans and Houston. And we all know that we are here not as ideologues, not as partisans, but as the elected representatives of American people, telling Washington that power comes from America's communities to our capital and not vice versa, and that Americans are demanding action to solve the two most pressing concerns they have. Will there be a future Earth for my children and their children? And will there be a place in the economy for us all today? In Los Angeles, we're trying to boldly put forward a Green New Deal at the urban level, as many other cities are. A city where we reduced by 11% our emissions in 2016 while we reduced unemployment by 14%. A place that we can take the car and traffic capital of America and hopefully turn into a public transportation and electric vehicle capital. A place where we make huge strides in creating jobs as we also look at ways of creating more inclusive and equitable society. In LA, we were able to, in just the last year alone, we had 40% of all cars purchased were electric. And we saw an 80% increase in the total number of electric vehicles from 2017 to 2018 from our government. That's 60,000 new cars that are running on LA roads without expelling any toxic fumes. And you see the bus behind us, we know that not only is it cheaper, it's better to be able to have electric vehicles. As of this year, in our city, we've installed 2,300 publicly available EV chargers. We're rewiring most of our street lamps to be able to, when you convert them to LED, take the excess voltage and use them for chargers. And we were one of the first cities to sign on to the C40, which is the global mayor's group on the environment, fuel-free streets declaration, so that we will only purchase zero emission buses by 2025. That's just a few years away, and I think we can probably beat that. And by the time all of you come and some great Americans come to compete and win in the Olympics and Paralympics in 2028, we will have a fleet that is maybe 100% electric buses by then. Whether it's a fleet car, whether it's our public transportation, the time to act is now. And mayors know that the spirit of collaboration is everything. If we're going to turn the tide on climate change, it has to start with working together. And that's why today we're pleased to, again, inform cities across this country, folks here in Hawaii and around the world, that we have an electric vehicle purchasing collaborative. Essentially, it says, if one of us is buying vehicles for our city, that might be in a big city, a relatively big contract, but it's a drop in the bucket. But when the cities of America together say, in the next few years, we're going to be buying hundreds of thousands of vehicles from our ports to our airports, our public transportation systems, our police officers, et cetera, we suddenly become a collaborative that can reduce the price and send a signal to industry, make those vehicles now and we will buy them. I remember when I was touring around the former mayor of New Orleans when he was in town, when he was heading up this conference, Mitch Landrieu, and I said, let's go check out these electric vehicles that my police officers are driving. And all the non-cruisers now that we're buying for the detectives and other people and civilians are electric vehicles. And we saw the bank of all the chargers, and we saw all the cars. And then he went up to one of the cops and he said, hey, forget what this mayor is saying. Tell me, what do you really think of these electric cars? And it was a 30-year-old veteran of the Los Angeles Police Department detective. And he said, well, you know, when I started looking at them, I wasn't sure it was an electric vehicle, but it drives real nice. And you know the best thing, Mayor? It's reducing my carbon footprint. And so, you know, when police officers are speaking about the urgency of this moment, that it is beginning to percolate and get through. We want to make it clear to every automaker, every vehicle manufacturer, if you build electric cars, America's cities will buy them and put them on our roads. So we are making it easy for any city, anywhere, to cut pollution, save money on fuel, and preserve the planet at the same time. Initially, it was 30 cities and two counties that came together to put that signal out to the market. Those 30 cities represent 114,000 vehicles across their fleets and $10 billion we use to purchase those vehicles. Today we have 127 cities, 9 counties, and 2 port authorities that have joined this movement. Together we're going to save more than 1 million gallons of gas every year. That's the power of climate mayors. But we want to take things a step further, and that's why we're growing this project and building our kids into the equation. By the end of the year, we are proud to announce we're going to expand this collaborative to include electric school buses. It's often kids who are in diesel buses, breathing those fumes, waiting at the bus stops. 470,000 school buses across America deliver our most precious asset, our children, to their schools every single day. That's 470,000 opportunities to go electric. More than 1 million trips every single day that makes sure that our kids won't be breathing exhaust, that won't put smog into our air. It's an ambitious plan, but we're an ambitious group.
This idea of a HUI driving the electric vehicle effort was just one of several ideas that came out of the Climate Summit. The conference also threw a different light on other modes of green transportation, including electric scooters. Here's Josh Stambro, the city's Office of Climate Sustainability and Resiliency, talking more about green mobility.
What are the companies that are making electric buses that can be purchased through the Electric Vehicle Collaborative? What are the micromobility solutions? You heard from the mayor of Austin in there. They have 400,000 electric scooter rides a month. And so that is taking a ton of people out of cars and getting them onto a zero emission solution that they can get around the city. Now you got to make sure that that fits the culture and the place. We got to make sure that that's not on our sidewalks. We want to make sure that they're in a place where they're safe and separate. But that's really the future, is micromobility, bikes, bike lanes, and e-scooters. And that's what we're learning about. How are cities wrestling with these new forms of transportation, and how do you make sure it works, you know, for the residents of your city, but also make sure that we're at a zero carbon economy?
You may recall Honolulu's recent less than exemplary experience with electric scooters last summer. The company Lime dropped some 200 scooters in Honolulu without going through proper channels. The city seized the scooters, and the city council is working on an ordinance to regulate the ever-changing world of new technology vehicles. We'll have more on those issues as they continue to develop.
I'm Ira Flato. On the next Science Friday, we wrap up the summer sensation of Cephalopod Week with octopus genes, giant squid, and your favorites.
My favorite cephalopod is the vampire squid, scientifically named Vampyrotuthis infernalis.
Your Ceph selections on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon from 1 to 3.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your Aloha Friday quiz. In today's Backyard Quiz, we're taking a field trip out to the baseball diamond and a mystery athlete known as one of the greatest pitchers in college baseball history. He graduated from Aiea High School and was known for a blazing fastball. Finished his senior year with an ERA of 0.34 and an unbelievable record of 27 wins and only a single loss. With the big leagues knocking at his door, this young pitcher chose to stick to his roots and play college ball at the University of Hawaii. During his time as a Rainbow, this sensational lefty shattered records, became the first college pitcher to win 20 games in a single season. Today's quiz? Easy. Just name this baseball great. You can call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. First one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors The Rice Partnership, Kaiser Permanente, and PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training.
As the Trump administration's trade dispute with China drags on, we're continuing our look at how that's affecting various local companies. Brad Dechter is the president of Dependable Hawaiian Express, DHX. That's a logistics company that provides freight services serving Hawaii, the U.S. mainland, and Asia. DHX is also an importer. It purchases materials and equipment from China to support its own operations. Brad spoke with HPR's Ryan Finnerty about how his company's feeling the effects of tariffs on Chinese goods.
First of all, working with our customers, nobody's happy. Nobody's happy at all. They see their bills going up, and there's no real payoff in it for them. They either pass it along to their customers, and their customers are upset about it, or they end up absorbing it, which they're upset about. From my standpoint as a service provider, our profits don't change when we go ahead and extend those duties and tariffs out to the government on behalf of our customers. So it's driving our rate of return on our dollars down. So it tends to inflate the transaction value. And it's an in and out with no profit. So it's just our cash being used with no payoff. We don't charge an additional fee, et cetera, for advancing those monies to customs.
So your company is actually the first one paying the tax, paying the tariff, and then your customers would reimburse you?
Yeah, it depends. There are two ways that goes. Some customers have their own accounts with customs, so they'll pay it directly. We just notify them of the amount. But most of our customers are small and medium-sized businesses that don't have those types of accounts with customs. So, yes, we go ahead and pay the funds on our customers' behalf, and then they reimburse us.
Could you give me a brief sense of who some of your customers are? What kind of businesses are they in? What kinds of products are they bringing in?
Oh, all kinds. We have tile customers. We have radiator customers. We have shelving customers. A lot of different business use type customers. We used to do a lot of consumer type products, clothing, et cetera. But a lot of that has dried up, and it really doesn't exist anymore. The whole market has sort of changed. It's funny, but I am on the advisory board of the University of Southern California, USC, supply chain program. And last August, USC had their annual summit, and there was a guy there who was, I think, assistant director from the Commerce Department. And I asked point blank at that time, because we had seen basically our exports to China sort of dry up. And I said to him, is there an informal boycott we don't know about going on where the Chinese are now not buying goods from the United States? And he looked at me and said, we're not aware of that. We'll get back to you. Well, nobody ever got back to me, and our exports to China haven't improved. The Chinese have got a system whereby they can pass a word and make things happen, and nobody ever knows. But I think we saw a boycott of our goods way before any of this went, escalated. As soon as these things came out, they were sending a message, don't screw around. But we continued to. At least that's my take on things. So we've seen our export business to Asia sort of dry up. On the import sides, we're paying out a lot more dollars, but not seeing any profits. It's a tough year if you're in the logistics service providing business and you're handling imports and exports. it's been a very tough year.
So what changes have you had to make as the person actually moving things from China to the United States? And what changes have you seen your customers have to make?
Well, I haven't seen my customers make too much in terms of changes other than they're buying less. So I guess it's at some point, even though the imports were rushing in heavily at one point, that was being done because not all the tariffs were enforced and people were trying to beat the deadline. I would think that at some point they're going to start slowing up as the duties come on to all the other items that exist. Now, it may reduce our trade surplus, but if it does, it's because everybody's paying duties. And those duties ultimately will be absorbed by U.S. companies or passed on to the U.S. Purchasers. What the changes I've seen is I've had to reduce the size of my staff in Hong Kong and Singapore and Shanghai because the activity just isn't there the way it used to be.
Some of the managers and business owners that I've spoken with have said that they're already exploring alternatives to Chinese producers if they haven't already made the switch. Is that something you've evidenced in the goods that you're shipping and the traffic that you're handling?
Well, I've seen it over the years, but frankly, this happened about 2 or 3 years ago. See, what happened was as China's middle class grew, labor got more expensive. As these people moved into the cities and needed housing and places to stay, the average wages in China grew, and that got passed on there. So there are places like, it used to be all the garments were manufactured in China. Well, between the pollution issues that caused in China, as well as wages being raised, most of the people that ran those factories have now moved those factories to Vietnam or other places where the labor is cheaper and the laws about pollution aren't as tough. And China never had tough laws, but they've gotten tougher in the last few years, and what will happen is they'll go over to Vietnam, they'll pollute that, and then in 2 or 3 years, the Vietnamese will start saying, we can't have all of our rivers polluted, and they'll start putting in new laws, and then they'll move somewhere else. There's a lot of that goes on. Factories that get moved to the cheapest labor and or least, those that have the least pollution laws.
Okay. Brad, one of the issues that's been raised as I've been having these conversations is the uncertainty factor that importers, people who are bringing in goods from China, don't know what tariff they're going to have to pay when their good arrives because the tariffs have been kind of raised in an erratic or unpredictable manner, and a lot of people don't know exactly when their container is going to hit the port because some of these things are ordered months in advance. So could you explain a little bit of what actually goes on down at a port, at a customs facility, when we've got a container ship coming in from China or some foreign port? How does that all play out?
I can't exactly tell you how it works. I know that what happens is based on manifest coming into the country. Customs will normally select some containers to be examined. They will look at others for what the goods are to make sure that they're described properly. They may look for bug infestations, but they look for different things depending on which part of it the world it's from. It could be infestation. Depending on if they think somebody's misdescribing a product to try to get around the duties, they may select that. And it really does vary. I know when we first ordered our building for Honolulu, it was a metal building. Well, it was manufactured in China. So the building, my contractor calls me up and says, I hate to tell you this, we got another $400,000 in duties we have to pay because the building's coming in. When I bought my pallet racking, we did get stuck. I think it was like all in all, fees, duties, et cetera, another $60,000, $70,000, like a 10% upcharge on what we thought we were paying. And that's money we'll never see back.
So, Brad, looking big picture, it's now looking like this dispute is not going to be resolved anytime soon. What are you thinking about long term as you make your plans for the next several years?
Well, it's very tough for us on the global side at this point to make any plans. Every day is a different day. You talk about the disruption in the speed of business. Well, right now we can't even plan because we don't know what's going to happen next. It's just, I've never been in this type of a world. And I've been doing this here for 36 years. And it's sad because you don't know what's going to happen next. So it's not business as usual. It's business on your tippy toes, trying to stay ahead of the game or at least even with it.
All right. We'll have to leave it at that. Brad Dechter, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome.
Brad Dechter is the president of DHX, Dependable Hawaiian Express. You can find the rest of our series on how local companies are feeling the heat from the trade dispute at hawaiipublicradio.org. We heard earlier in the newscast, a federal judge has ordered former prosecutor Catherine Kealoha to be jailed immediately following her conviction, along with that of her husband, former police chief Louis Kealoha. Honolulu Civil Beat's Nick Gruby has been following this case literally for years and joins us with more. Nick, this morning's action by Judge Michael Seabright came with a pretty sharp tone attached.
Hi, Bill. Yeah, that's right. Judge Seabright basically told Catherine Kealoha and her attorneys before sending her to jail that obstruction of justice really is her bread and butter. Those were his words. And he also laid out the many allegations, some of which have been proven now, against her, including that she conspired with police officers to frame her uncle for the theft of her mailbox, that she tried to get her grandmother declared incompetent. Seabright particularly focused on the fact that she had actually stolen money from her grandmother as well, something that was proven during the trial as motive evidence, but is also part of an upcoming trial involving other financial crimes that she and her husband, Louis Kealoha, are accused of committing.
And as you mentioned, just on the timeline of all of this, I know there's a lot still to come. But just for a moment, in terms of that which you've been through in the recent past, this was a relatively fast jury deliberation.
That's right. I think it surprised a lot of people that the decision came as quickly as it did. It was about a day, and I think that. You know, speaking with lawyers, that sort of speaks to a couple of things. One is that maybe the government did a really great job proving its case, even though it was incredibly complex and convoluted at times. You know, they had dozens and dozens of witnesses. We're talking about a lot of different dates and times of things, of various incidents and circumstantial evidence, et cetera. But that fast verdict may have been an attempt to send a message that, hey, we believe what the government's saying about four out of the five of you. Of course, they did let Gordon Shiraishi, who was accused of taking part in the conspiracy, walk. But that could be an indication that they took their job seriously as well, and they didn't just want to go in there and hammer down on the defendants, but that they actually thought, you know, maybe there is enough reasonable doubt to let Gordon Shiraishi walk away from these charges.
You know, throughout this trial, and every trial sort of has a different feel within the courtroom, and sometimes that feeling can shift during the trial itself. What was that like for you in terms of your sense of what the atmosphere in the courtroom was like and evolved to over the course of the trial?
Well, I think this trial really came down to the testimony of Florence Puana, the 99-year-old grandmother of Catherine K. Aloha. She didn't get to testify in the courtroom because of health reasons, but they did do a video deposition with her. But I think most people found her testimony to be incredibly powerful and emotional as she sat there on video with a magnifying glass looking over financial documents and pointing out all of the money that she says her grandmother stole or granddaughter stole from her. She cried at one point as she said, "I trusted her." After her video deposition testimony was played, we walked out of the courtroom and there were some spectators who were actually crying. And I think that was a very heavy, powerful, emotional moment that ultimately, I think, changed some minds in that courtroom.
You know, from you mentioned before, in terms of this is just in some ways just the beginnings for the Kealohas. From here, sentencing in October, and there's more.
There is, and Assistant U.S. Attorney Michael Wheat, who's the special prosecutor in this case, came out and gave a brief statement to the press, and he made clear this is just the first chapter. This is the beginning. The Kealohas face another trial in October for the alleged financial crimes related to bank fraud and identity theft, as well as obstruction of justice. They also, Catherine Kealoha also faces drug charges in a case in which she and her younger brother are accused of running a prescription drug ring in part to feed his cocaine habit, and her using her position as a city prosecutor to sort of hide that from federal local investigators. Now, that's not it. I mean, in addition to the Kealohas, Michael Wheat and his team are also investigating Honolulu prosecuting attorney Keith Kaneshiro, who is Catherine Kealoha's former boss, as well as Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell's top civil lawyer, Donna Leong. Both Leong and Kaneshiro have received target letters from the Justice Department indicating that they are suspected of criminal activity. What that criminal activity is, we can only sort of guess to right now, but for Leong, it's believed that that activity involves a $250,000 payment she helped negotiate for Louis Kealoha after he was named a target of the Justice Department's criminal investigation in 2017.
A lot to go through, a lot to sort through. Unfair question, but briefly, what are you watching for next beyond the logistics themselves?
Well, now that Catherine Kealoha is in jail, I am interested to see what the sentences are for the various defendants. There's a range. The federal sentencing guidelines are complicated and convoluted. You know, the judge can make the decision to throw the book at the Kealohas in this case if he finds that they did abuse their positions of power and their positions of trust within the community. He can increase their sentence to really send a message. And so I'm curious to see that, but I'm also curious to see how the rest of the community responds, because this case, now that there is a conviction in it, people who may not have fully believed or trusted in the federal government
a bit of a faith renewed in that. Nick, thanks. Sorry to cut you off, but that is Civil Beat's reporter Nick Gruby. You can find all his reporting on this case at civilbeat.org. Earlier this week, we talked about invasive species. Ask for your feedback. Here's what we heard from the talkback line.
I discovered I had a little fire ants on my 18,000 square foot lot above the Kona Airport. I have pets, so I can't spray with anything to toxicants. We'd been noticing stings, but never figured out where they were coming from when we were pruning the trees. So I got in touch with the ant lab and started treating my property with Tango religiously, and it's been quite helpful. I still have fire ants, but have reduced the population to what I'd consider to be tolerable. I get when I go out in the yard and begin pruning trees, I get one bite maybe or maybe two once in a while. Unfortunately, only my neighbor across the street is interested in testing and treating. The other neighbors apparently haven't noticed the problem, and ones I talked to were not interested in even testing for it. It'd be really good if somehow the community was warned, because I really didn't know I had them until they were really heavy all over my property.
This is Dorothy Sanger, and I was calling from the Big Island, and I had a suggestion that you guys might want to get a hold of the Coyle Romberg. He invented this product, BioWash, and it helps with the trees. And then also he has a product for the leaves, which helps the trees grow and produce more and helps with the invasive bugs. And just a separate issue, I have had success with just straight vinegar killing the ants around the house, around the cement where the ants are. That really has helped. So I just wanted to share that information. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
And thank you so much for the feedback. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, or you can call our talkback line, 792-8217.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaii Performing Arts Festival, celebrating Independence Day with classics from the Great American Songbook, July 3rd at Cafe Il Mondo in Honoka'a. Tickets at hawaiiperformingartsfestival.org.
Coming Saturday, June 29th to HPR's Atherton Studio. It's an evening of guitar-forward folk, Americana, and blues music from Tuality, featuring Maui guitar maker Steve Grimes. For tickets, visit hprtickets.org or call the station during business hours. Sponsored by Amoresco.
Heard you been talking about the things I do. You don't pull no punches, baby, since we're through.
Esports is a $1 billion industry, and it's growing. Cities around the world are holding esports tournaments, hoping to attract younger visitors and become major destinations for the industry. But what would it take for Hawaii to become a player in esports? HPR's Casey Harlow goes in search of answers.
This is Andy Nakamura, a senior at Iolani. He began playing video games around the first grade. He's like a lot of teenagers today and plays the PC game League of Legends.
I like League because it's a five-person multiplayer game. 5 against 5, just random on the internet, and I get to work with 4 of my friends, and we try to achieve a common goal together and win.
It's gamers like Andy who have caught the attention of local government officials. They like that esports attracts young audiences and multi-million dollar sponsorships. Sky Kavaloa is a PhD student at the University of Hawaii, one of the country's few academics researching esports.
Arlington in Texas built out a massive esports stadium for $10 million. Atlantic City in New Jersey is looking to esports as part of their overall platform of being kind of the game center in the East Coast, and saying esports could be another way to attract a younger, millennium-based crowd to their city.
He says cities like Las Vegas, New York City, and Seattle are becoming known as destinations for esports. But could Hawaii get on this train?
I think a very important and probably a significant first step was to have a tournament here in Hawaii. A large tournament that is sponsored by endemic gaming or a technology company. That would be the low-hanging fruit in which we could immediately accomplish.
So are there any tournaments coming to Hawaii soon?
We haven't been formally presented with any kind of opportunity yet.
Keith Regan is the chief administrative officer for the Hawaii Tourism Authority. He says an esports tournament would benefit the state's tourism industry.
Based on some preliminary research that, you know, we've been doing, the demographics are pretty good. The folks that travel and participate in esports, either just by viewing or by actually playing in the games, they're making pretty good money. And I think there's a good opportunity to, you know, possibly tap into that market.
But some see the benefits of esports stretching beyond tourism. State Senator Glenn Wakai is one of them. He chairs the Senate's Economic Development and Tourism Committee.
we don't do enough to leverage tourism as a catalyst for other types of business opportunities. So e-gaming is kind of one of those opportunities. Our first crack will be to get tourists here for a convention, but really use that to grow a fundamental software game development industry here in the state.
Wakai sees esports gaining traction at Hawaii universities and high schools with classes and competitions, all of which could fuel economic opportunities. But there are serious hurdles, and that could slow tech expansion here, including in esports.
There are two fundamental changes that need to be developed. One is broadband capacity. The second is cost of electricity.
Broadband is our internet infrastructure. It's the pipeline dictating how much and at what speed information gets to and from the islands. Wakai says the state's broadband capacity is limited, and efforts to improve it failed at the state legislature this year.
There's a South American cable that's going to Asia, and they're going to bypass us unless we provide the infrastructure to be able to kind of plug and play in Hawaii. So we really need to get going on beefing up our infrastructure so that we have the ability to do e-gaming, to watch Netflix, and everything else that society demands.
Wakai says he plans to reintroduce the measure to beef up Hawaii's digital infrastructure in the next legislative session. Despite the setback, Kavaloa says Hawaii is in a prime position to take advantage of esports.
Activate recently came out with a statistic saying that in 2022, Asia Pacific is going to be capturing a large portion of the revenue that the esports industry is going to generate. Asia Pacific, we're right in the middle of that.
For Iolani Sr. Andy Nakamura, Hawaii's infrastructure could mean more than a better gaming experience. He's interested in a career in some part of esports, whether the state becomes a player in the industry or not. From Hawaii Public Radio, I'm Casey Harlow.
And Casey joins us now with a bit more on that story. Casey, a lot of threads in that in terms of roles for Hawaii to from broadband to the HTA. What in terms of, I guess, what do we need to do first?
The answer is kind of simple, and Sky actually had a very good soundbite in there. It's very low-hanging fruit. All we have to do is just hold a tournament here. And a tournament doesn't take a whole heck of a lot. I guess it's just a tournament, or the right tournament, has to approach the HTA, and then the HTA will do its research of the economic benefits and everything else, and then they'll say, okay, yeah, we would like to have an esports tournament. And from my understanding with and my discussion with Keith Regan, he's very interested in having an esports tournament here. The HTA is over the moon. They would like to have like here. But the problem is further down the line. Our broadband isn't that great. And Sky actually says he gets very technical about it. It's basically the response time of when someone hits a key on the computer and how fast that gets to the server.
Well, and it's a basic electronic infrastructure. Anybody who's spent any time in South Korea and then come back to Hawaii, it's sort of a bad wake-up call on that score.
And South Korea is the leader in esports. Mm. It's basically they have an economy surrounding esports. That's what it is. And for Hawaii, talking to Glenn Wakai, he really wants to beef up the infrastructure here. And I could spend a whole nother piece just talking about the issues and the hurdles. And I have a quick little soundbite here, which we could play, and it kind of gets the gist of the hurdles of why the legislature hasn't allocated $10 million this past legislative session for something in Kaka'ako.
Because we don't know what we need in the future. We're all kind of happy with our ability to go on Facebook and go to Instagram, and it functions now. But as more and more demands are placed on our broadband capacity, it's not going to function. One day, Hawaii is going to embrace the idea of autonomous vehicles. We have to have the infrastructure ready for that day. There's no way we could have autonomous vehicles with our poor infrastructure capacity as it is today. So it's a matter of just not knowing what the future holds and not preparing for it. We're too complacent here in the state.
And, I mean, that kind of is the gist of it. We're complacent now, but we're not preparing enough for the future to maybe adopt some new technology that is coming down the pike, because technology is very much on the cutting edge. It's now, right? And if we want to adopt autonomous vehicles and we don't have the infrastructure, it's not going to happen.
Well, it's interesting that the idea of esports being almost a building block towards that broader infrastructure, because sometimes, especially when you're talking about, you know, $10 million at the legislature, which is a competitive atmosphere in terms of everybody's got their hand out of, we've got projects for this, it costs X. You know, $10 million is not necessarily a small amount, but that idea that it helps build not only technology philosophical sense, but very specifically, here's esports, here's a tie into the Hawaii Tourism Authority, here's a tie into a major tournament and to economic development in Hawaii.
Yeah, and I like what Kai said in the piece. Basically, he sees it beyond tourism, right? We can develop something more here in Hawaii with esports. It doesn't have to be solely on tourism.
Mm-hmm.
We can develop and have a local gaming industry, local developers here in the state using esports.
And that also builds into a broader education piece. There's a lot in terms of the collaboration aspect of this.
Exactly.
And all part of our Asia-Pacific neighborhood.
Exactly.
Great. Very good. Nice reporting.
Thanks.
Casey Harlow, you can find his stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org. This morning, we asked you to name one of college baseball's greatest pitchers. Wearing jersey number 16, this player helped put the University of Hawaii Rainbows on the map during his three seasons on the mound. With 40 winning games, a nasty curveball, and a blazing fastball up his sleeve, he was known as a strikeout king, whiffing 234 batters in 1979 alone. His talent didn't go unnoticed. In his junior year, he was lured away by a $750,000 contract and a career playing ball in Japan. As it happened, his departure from UH was just before the Rainbows played in the 1980 College World Series. UH would go on to lose to Arizona in that one, and many say it never would have happened if Derek Tatsuno had been on the team. With that said, Derek Tatsuno is the answer to today's quiz. And did you know that in 2007, he was inducted into the College Baseball Hall of Fame? Ren from Kaimuki knew about that. Big fan of UH baseball, knows his history. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. In every city, every community really, there are various scenes you could describe as underground. That's true in Honolulu when it comes to a lot of activities, and one of them is the big band scene. HPR's Noe Tanigao has been out in that and has some notes from underground.
I'm telling you, it's so much fun, Bill, to check this all out. I found out you can find big band music live three nights a week.
Wow.
Rehearsing in Honolulu. And I was real lucky to first find the Monday night band rehearsing at Washington Middle School one Monday night. They formed back in 1982 or 83.
Wow.
For the purpose of playing big band swing. Okay, now, here's the genealogy of this group from somebody who was there. Russ Lum, trombone, de facto leader now of the Monday night band since they lost their recent guiding light, Wayne Kawahara. Now, he's going to tell us how this Monday night band started, and all the people mentioned mean so much to music in Hawaii.
The leader of the summer concert band was Don Morosi, the former director of the Punahou Band. And one of the participants was an alto saxophonist by the name of Jack Darville, who is the former head of Kamehameha Schools. So it was actually, I guess, his idea to start a summer big band. At the end of the summer, normally we would the summer concert band would disband, and Jack Darville came up with the idea, well, why don't we do this on a Monday night year-round? Yeah, we ended up rehearsing Monday nights at Kamehameha Schools under the leadership of Jack Darville. And he was a wonderful leader.
That is the typical kind of in-between songs there. You can hear people kind of jostling, talking, joking in the background. Well, what does the music sound like? Big band swing? Live at the Washington Intermediate.
You know, I see sort of just visually just sort of a sweeping camera of a big room with dance period, I don't know.
Exactly, but, a tiered showroom. Yes. That's how these guys sound. It really is. You know, Kamehameha Schools hosts a jazz showcase for high school, college, and community bands still annually. I mean, this music is happening. And you know what? There's a lot of big band at New Hope every Sunday at Farrington High School. Mm-hmm. Jonathan Kabagbeg's a part of that. He's lead alto sax player, plays also flutes and clarinets, and this is why he likes playing.
Some guys go golfing, bowling, we go play music. And I just love it. I just work 10 hours at the post office, but I make my way here every Monday just to be a part of this.
You work at the post office? You
yes.
put in a full day, then you come?
10 hours today, 10 hours plus, yeah.
Right.
But I just love to do this because we get to hone our crafts and just have a good time, not only learning, but hanging out with different people from different backgrounds.
I'll say.
Yeah.
That's nice. Again, it's such a mood creating set of audio. The music, it just puts your mind in a particular place. It's very visual to me, actually.
Yeah, it is. Oh, man. Psychiatrist Dr. Robert Marvitt's one of the players of fame. In fact, he's lead tenor player. You heard him right there. 81 years old. He's worked in rehab medicine and with music therapy. Why play music?
You don't get into physical shape by watching sporting events. You don't get your brain wound up by listening to music as much as you do if you play music. You're really exercising all kinds of areas. Memory, recall, motor control. I believe that playing music will keep your brain functional and more effective regardless of what the aging process does to you.
Plausible.
That's an interesting set of points, just thinking of instrumentation from the manual dexterity to the embouchure to breath control, all kinds of things.
And, you know, just trying to achieve a sound. He's onto something there. Mm-hmm. Okay, this past Wednesday, I found myself exiting an elevator, walking down an endless hospital corridor, and I start to hear the Shriners Big Band. They rehearse at the basement of the hospital Wednesday nights. And Santo DiMartino is the leader of the Shriners Band. He has been for 20 years.
Years ago, even before my time, and I'm 73, it was the music of the day, and it was made for dancing and enjoying. And where the big bands were, that's where everyone went because folks did a lot more dancing, which doesn't happen a lot nowadays, but still with these older tunes that we do and we appeal to the older folks, they'll actually get up and do the old bebop and waltzes and older kind of dances. So we're keeping that music alive and they're keeping us alive by enjoying
A lot of the same people play in the same bands. I mean, the age range is so incredible, maybe 30s to 90 plus.
Wow.
in these groups.
You know, another part of that, too, is a real sound feel for acoustics in these different areas of describing sort of down, you know, down a hospital corridor and all of that. The places that you hear this, that is such a part of that sound as well.
Because it's in our community. It's been there. It's just woven in. I mean, when you think about what musicians have to go through in this town, Phil Schilato, for example, he still plays professionally, Jazz Minds, second and fourth Mondays. He came over in the 70s with a job playing in a showroom. In the 70s, there were tons of showrooms with a lot of people dancing everything on stage. And I tell you, those jobs have dried up. You'd think teaching, that'd be great. But, you know, I heard that teachers all got fired and they got switched around. Band teachers have had a tough time, but they keep the music going.
That's great. Underground scene, big band.
Who knew?
Noe Tani Gowad did. She's our arts and culture reporter, of course. And you can find this story and a lot more at HawaiiPublicRadio.org. Thanks, Noe.
Thank you.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programs. Mahalo to contributors Ekahi Health, Ulupono Initiative, and Impact Hub Honolulu Co-Working.
Hawaii Public Radio is looking for a community-minded business development professional to join our underwriting team as a corporate relations associate. If you're experienced in establishing new corporate support business, enriching existing relationships, and ensuring client satisfaction, we want to hear from you. A love for public radio is a plus. Read more about the position at hawaiipublicradio.org. Application deadline is June 30th.
That's The Conversation for this week. Coming next week, the Supreme Court shot down the Trump administration's citizenship question on the census, but the story's not over, and it's got a special resonance here in Hawaii. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line, leave your comments, 808-792-8217, email to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org, comments on Facebook at The Conversation HPR, or tweet us at HI Conversation. The program is produced by Lillian Song, Ryan Finity, and Harrison Patino. Our summer intern is Savannah Harriman-Pote. The Backyard Quiz theme written for us by John DeMello. I'm Bill Dorman. Join us on Monday and pick up The Conversation.